Welcome to the February 2019 Rehab Cast from the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. I'm your host, Dr. Ford Vox. Now this April, ACRM is going to be hosting its first ACRM Training Institute in Chicago. The ATI offers instructional courses with continuing education credits and your choice of 11 different disciplines. You can check it out at acrm.org under Spring Meeting 2019. Let's get right into this month's featured study with Dr. Samantha Backhouse. Dr. Backhouse is a clinical neuropsychologist at the Rehabilitation Hospital of Indiana's Comprehensive Outpatient Brain Injury Neuro Rehab Center. Dr. Backhouse and her colleagues have published in the archives of PM&R an investigation of a new couples intervention for individuals with brain injury. It's a randomized controlled trial. Dr. Backhouse, thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Well, I know that you have a heavy focus in this area of couples therapy and have done some other work with regards to various forms of group therapy and so forth after brain injury. Bring us up to speed a little bit about your areas of research interest versus kind of what you do focus on clinically.
Sure. Well, as far as research goes, I have a specific interest more in looking at clinical translational world where we study different interventions and try to determine if they have any positive effects or benefits for the individuals that participate in these types of interventions so that we can eventually start using them with these individuals with brain injury and their significant others or family members. And we are really focused, and my particular focus is more sort of long-term quality of life issues. So I focus a lot on psychosocial functioning and mood, relationships, sort of the things that we think about, other things, right, besides our, in addition to our jobs and being able to drive, that also, you know, bring about meaning in our life of who we are, what our identity is, and what brings us joy.
And I see here, looking in your background, that 10 years ago now, you developed this brain injury coping skills group. And perhaps that's a precursor to the type of work that you're doing now. Would you tell me about that?
Sure. Yes, you're correct. It is actually a precursor to the couple study. So the brain injury coping skills group was developed really just kind of first and foremost, when I got here to this setting and started practicing, it has been clear that these individuals were struggling. And, you get kind of discharged from your therapies and however many sessions you get. And I think a lot of people reported that they felt like they were just sort of left in this black hole and kind of abyss, so to speak. And I wanted to really address that need that was there. And so what happened is that started doing some research on, well, what do people say that their needs are after they're discharged, and how important is family to that process, right? And what does the family report that their needs are? Because we do know that how the family deals and copes with these types of traumatic situations can absolutely influence the rehabilitation outcome of the person that has the injury. So started doing a lot of research and actually found a lot of great articles that had already been published by Jeff Kreutzer, who really looked a lot into this area and came up with some pretty common themes of what families will report their needs are. So started putting together, we thought, well, it might be nice actually if we did this in a group format, first of all, and because I think that people want support and people want to know that there are other people out there that are like them. So, and we also know that at that time, there were some group interventions that were developed for, I'm just going to use the word survivor here, or the person that had the injury. And then there are also group interventions for caregivers alone or family members alone. But At that point, there weren't any interventions that were developed where you would combine the survivor of the injury and a caregiver or family member, and then have them as a dyad go through the group so that people can receive support from each other in that way. So we did, at that point, we developed a 12 session group, and then it eventually turned into 16 sessions, and had a lot of support actually. So most unfortunately, during the sort of the genesis of that project, there was a family member that came to our hospital who wanted to help, and apparently their daughter, who is a very, very well-known physician actually in this community, had suffered a traumatic brain injury, and she had gone through sort of the general course of therapies, but there was not a lot of family education or support that occurred, and they wanted to make a difference. So the daughter unfortunately took her life 4 years after the injury happened. And so that it was, of course, extremely heartbreaking and unfortunate, and fit, you know, with what we were learning, that it doesn't matter how long, you know, it's been since the injury occurred. It's not just about the first 6 months or the first year, but that people are at risk for these types of challenges for years post injury, and without appropriate family involvement and support, that it really will just tear apart the whole system.
And to be clear, this initial brain injury coping skills group is what evolved into the Couples Caring and Relating with Empathy After Brain Injury program?
Yes, yeah. Okay. Because that group was for dyads, which were, you know, it could be a survivor and a mother, a daughter, right? It could be a brother or a sister, just anyone that was close to them that needs to have some understanding of what happened to their loved one. Mm-hmm. So from that group, so basically actually that group, 50%, like the first 8 weeks were really focused on a lot of psychoeducation and training about the effects of the injury. But then the last 8 weeks were focused on stress management and how to cope and deal with ongoing chronic issues for years after injury. And part of the stress management skills were skills on communication and listening to one another's needs. And so time after time, after we had, we published a couple of studies on that group, but after we had been running this group clinically for years, almost in every group, of course, you know, not only will you have, you know, your other kind of dyads, like I just described, but you're also going to have married couples or couples in relationships. Mm-hmm. And those couples, almost 100% of the time would say, man, we really wish, like, we just love this and we just want this to continue. And so now we have the core skills and the core foundation for understanding the injury and maybe some stress and coping skills. But now we want to know how to deal with each other. Like, how do we deal with our relationship? Because this has changed. This is different for us. It's, you know, we're in a new relationship, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So even the marriage has become a new normal. So that's how we developed the idea, actually from feedback.
That's what people wanted. Yeah. So patient-centered research. Yeah. And patient-centered focus on outcomes. That's great. And you start out, you talk about there's certainly a wide literature on couples therapy, some of which has great parallels to brain injury. I found that portion of your paper quite fascinating. Tell us about that and how some of the issues that people deal with in you know, so-called quote-unquote normal marriages unaffected by brain injury are so similar.
I was actually taken aback by that as well, and I thought that was really neat in some ways. So some of the most common themes in the general literature that people will often report sort of leads to marital distress or themes surrounding that are issues with communication with each other. So then they will grow apart from each other. Another big issue that people will report is when if someone is having just sort of general coping issues, and not too severe, but even just kind of, if one of the individuals is going through depression or anxiety, or maybe that's that they have sort of a long-standing depressive disorder, and they're very likely to have a lot of misperceptions in the relationship. And so by that, that could simply mean you're, walking around and you're at home and, I always give the example, I look at my husband, and if my husband is sighing, I personalize that. And I think, wow, he's upset with me. I've done something wrong. And, and if you're a person that has, just some general insecurities, or if you're a person that has a lot of anxiety or depression to begin with, then you're much more likely to hold on to those misperceptions and never talk about that, never communicate about that, but only respond on that. So now you withdraw from the relationship, mm-hmm. right? So those are very general patterns that can occur in most, or in sort of the general population. And then finally, the other theme that popped up that I thought was interesting is that, there is a fair number of individuals that not only have general kind of issues with stress and coping, but huge sort of emotional dysregulation issues. So, by that, maybe one of the spouses might say, gosh, I can't do anything right. I feel like I'm walking on eggshells. I can't ever say the right thing. I can't ever do the right thing. I don't know when you're going to blow up. I don't know when you're, and so that, I was actually surprised to find that was out there in sort of the general population, that people have a difficult time dealing with significant, when one of the spouses has some emotional discontrol or emotional dysregulation issues. So, you might be talking about people like with anger management problems or something like that. So when you take it from there, then what, I looked at that type of literature, and then when I was looking around about like other studies that have been done, I was, it makes sense to me that there were some studies that used what we call cognitive behavioral marital interventions, where you try to change your perceptions, right? And you try to catch yourself when you're having misperceptions of what your spouse is saying, you try to use some good coping skills such as relaxation strategies and self, trying to, use good self-reassurance. But I was actually surprised that there had been some studies, group studies actually, that were for individuals that had these emotional dysregulation issues. And in particular, let's say individuals that have been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder.
Okay.
Right. So, yeah, and kind of at that core, they have a lot of emotional instability, and they're very sensitive to criticism sometimes. And so those particular strategies, like there have been dialectical behavioral groups that were marital groups that were developed for that. And then you look at the the population with brain injury who develop cognitive issues that, of course, not only affect their cognition and, what we think of as attention and short-term memory, but it affects the way that they communicate with each other. And it affects their, own sense of identity. It promotes, it significantly reduces their sense of security and confidence. And so now they're much more likely to misperceive what's going on in the relationship. They're much more likely to read into situations. And many of those individuals may also struggle a lot with that significant emotional dysregulation that almost can mimic individuals that have mania or that have borderline personality. And it just seemed to actually, it was a really nice fit. Like I was pleasantly surprised, right, that it wasn't that we felt the need to develop something incredibly different, but rather to look at what's been out there and what the themes are in both populations, the general and the population that's had brain injury, and look at you know, what has been done and how can that be modified to really fit the needs of these individuals and their relationships.
And you mentioned the term dialectical behavior therapy. How do we describe that as opposed to cognitive behavioral therapy?
Cognitive behavioral therapy will, in general, focus, they have a strong focus on looking at a person's perceptions that they have in a particular situation or towards someone. They'll try to get a person to identify, you know, what types of misperceptions they might be having, and then give them some strategies to maybe modify the way that they think about that situation, the way that they look at it more realistically, look at it more reassuringly, try to reframe it. And the behavioral aspect of that will incorporate strategies like using timeouts, using relaxation, some deep breathing, scheduling your week with pleasurable events just to sort of enhance your mood. So it incorporates, right, both aspects of that. And, you know, dialectical behavioral therapy, I mean, I just think that they all have aspects that are really similar with each other. So it's not that we certainly would not look at the person's perceptions in dialectical behavioral therapy, but the dialectical part of that is getting a person to understand that in some of the perceptions that they have, they tend to be very extreme. So, you know, and the dialectical aspect is trying to get that person to think more in the middle somewhere, more in the balance of that. And instead of thinking all or nothing, right, I either love you, I hate you, that I can do both. You know, I can do a little of both and still be okay. But then also because people think in such extremes, that's why their emotions fit that. They go very extreme. So the behavioral part of that, which I think fits so nicely with this particular population of individuals that have had brain injury, is that it's really hard, I think, when you have intense emotions, as in people with brain injury, to have enough insight in that moment to sort of reason through something. Mm-hmm. And so in DBT, it's real focused on getting a person to make an immediate identification of, okay, right now I'm having a dysfunctional thought, or right now this isn't good. Okay, I'm going to step away from the situation and I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And it's, you know, so they're very specific techniques in getting them sort of less charged, less intense, calming a person down, getting them to develop more healthy habits, in addition to that, to sort of keep their sort of baseline functioning more calm and peaceful, as opposed to always being on heightened, kind of at a heightened state, because the more you're in a heightened state, the more you're going to react on your spouse.
You invoke the name John Gottman in particular for his large body of marital research that you drew from. What's the main theme of his work that was useful in porting over into this?
John Gottman and his partner Julie Gottman, they like I said in the paper, they are just leaders, or one of the leaders in the field of marital research. And the way I look at their work is, sometimes it's not so much a real specific intervention, but it's getting you to identify particular themes. So it helps you to look at the framework, and it gives you models. So for example, they're really big into communication, right? And so, yes, interpersonal communication skills is a part of DBT, and it can be a part of CBT, but they are really good at looking at it in the context of the relationship exchange. So how one person in that dyad, what is the exchange of verbal communication? What is the exchange of nonverbal communication, and even behaviors that they're doing within the relationship? And these exchanges, how they're perceived and how they're given, it's those exchanges that can sometimes be really nurturing for a relationship or really damaging for a relationship. So how Gottman comes into this is that A lot of the framework we used is educating people on, look, when you talk to your partner in this manner, in this way, then this is really destructive. This is really damaging. What you may think of as natural is just who I am, or everybody does it. There's research that shows that if you respond to your partner in that manner, that it'll probably predict with over 95% accuracy that relationship will end in divorce. And so, like, for example, one of the things that Gottman is known for is what they developed the term the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and they identified there were four specific themes of negative interaction patterns that people can engage in. And so we teach people, okay, what are these specific four horsemen? How do you identify it in yourself? How do you sort of stop yourself? How do you change that habit or alter that habit? And then we give them what we call the antidotes, right? So, like, instead of doing that, right, you can't just tell somebody to stop doing it without giving them something to replace it. So then you teach them other strategies. When you have the urge to do this, instead do this, or respond in this way. So, like that, there are many skills that oftentimes, again, even in general relationships, we take for granted, and we don't realize that this type of behavior is a negative exchange. It's called manipulation. It's a very passive aggressive approach, and we don't know that. We don't identify it, and nor do we communicate that that behavior is bothering us until we finally say, "I've had it." So we're trying to get people to communicate that, to identify all the different types of positive and negative exchanges in the relationship that they are having, and particularly for this population. Those exchanges may be new. And right. And so, because they now know about the effects of the injury, well, what's causing that, right? Is this pure laziness, or is this an initiation problem? Is this that they're purposely withdrawing from you, or is it because, their word finding issues? And how do they get around that? How do they get around their memory issues? And so you're teaching them to We're not only teaching them stress and coping techniques with each other, but also how to relate and find their partner again and accept who their partner is.
And you mentioned that four horsemen scale, which of course has quite an amazing name. And I see here it's 33 true false items, and they're centered around elucidating contempt, criticism, defensiveness, and stonewalling. So they're true false questions that I guess that each partner is asking about how they perceive the marriage or interactions, and is kind of scoring how much of those behaviors exist.
Yes.
And that's just one of three measures that you utilize to determine your outcomes here. You also use the dyadic adjustment scale, a self-report measure of marital adjustment and satisfaction, and the quality of marriage index, which is a just a six-item inventory on marriage quality through Global Ratings. Now it's a 16-week intervention. I see that there are 10 modules of content distributed over the course of that 16 weeks. Is that right?
Yes.
And it looks quite thorough, all the way from kind of the basics about kind of understanding the nature of the brain injury, changes in relationship, down to emotional intelligence, coping skills, and kind of relationship building exercises and so forth. So, but it's one session per week.
It's one, yes, that's right. So it's one session per week, which means that it might take a couple of weeks or several weeks to actually get through one module, if that makes sense.
I see.
So, like on the communication section, that's module 7, but it takes 3 sessions to get through that.
Y'all had good results, except for this quality of marriage index, which you discussed. Y'all didn't see a significant change there. And what are your general thoughts about that?
I am still on the fence with that. I mean, I kind of have to, certainly I accept that for what it is, and I'm not quite sure because when I was looking at other studies, so we actually, the first study that we published on it was a feasibility study, and in that study, we did find a significant improvement in the on the, that QMI or Quality of Marriage Index. And so we thought, well, let's use it again and see what happens. And then, of course, we don't find significant effects. And when I looked at other studies, that had used that, it was equivocal as well. There were studies that found that there were significant effects, and there were studies that didn't find it. And so I am on the fence about that. And I'll tell you that clinically, so we are now starting to run this group. And what I would really like to do is just continue to collect data and see, is it really capturing what I want it to capture? And truly, is it not changing? And what that would look like. So I haven't discarded it altogether. I'm not feeling confident about that particular measure, though.
Because I mean, oh, certainly besides the other two measures, you're also getting really good feedback from the participants about how much they feel like they're getting out of the process, which is really important as well, and kind of the individual aspects of it that they feel like that they're and the skills that they're building.
Yes, and that's actually such a valuable aspect of that. I really got a lot out of going through set the satisfaction measures and people's comments, what they were reporting, and I think a couple people have asked me why I chose to do this in a group format, and when I thought about it that way, initially I was kind of on the fence. I did BICS in the group format, and I know there have been other studies that have done group marital interventions, and because we know people that have had a brain injury or are suffering, with any significant issue, they oftentimes like to turn to others in similar situations. So I decided to give it a try, and in both publications, so in the feasibility study as well as this one that you're referring to, that was probably the number one comment that people really, really I mean, they can tell you certain sections that they really liked and certain sections that they perceive made substantial changes for them. But the largest subjectively reported benefit has been that they got to go through it with other people, which surprises me because I know how private we can be when it comes to our relationships.
And I think also you talk about your attrition rate and how that kind of matches or is similar to what normal couples therapy type interventions see. Yours was 10%, and I think that's probably must be equivalent to the low single digits for a quote unquote regular or non-brain injury associated group, because virtually every other intervention known to man for anything to do with the brain injury population, you have a higher attrition rate. And here you're getting other studies are saying anywhere from 11 to 60 plus percent attrition rates for various marriage interventions. It's kind of surprising to see the brain injury group on the low end. That's another measure of how much they must have been enjoying it or feel like they were getting out of it.
That's a nice finding. I guess I have some maybe speculation on that possibly. So I would love to say that, wow, they really, really liked the intervention and they really got a lot out of it. And I would love to feel that way. I also can say that I think in these attrition rates that we found were similar to what we found in the brain injury coping skills group. And I think that one of the things, one of the factors is that when I ask, so if it's just a quote survivor that's had an injury, or if it's just a family member, if the group is just for them, then I think sometimes it's a lot easier to, if you need to cancel a session or if you need to, if you can't make it, I think you don't feel as connected possibly. And I mean, I think, people do feel very connected in groups, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that when you have two people that are in the study together, what I have kind of overheard or even kind of joke, you know, people joking around being like, well, my spouse is making me come, you know, or right. And my partner's making me come. And even in the BICS, they would say that, right? Like, okay. And so, because then you go around that first day and ask why people are here, and, you know, a good percentage will say, well, I basically said they want to come. And so I guess I'm here.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing wrong with that, you know, the spouse is utilized in the rest of medicine for pretty much every other health intervention.
Yes.
So
yes.
Might as well. And maybe there's some peer pressure as well. I mean, is it the same group of people each session, each week, in which case, you know, others might notice if you're not there and have to explain why you weren't there last week and that type of thing?
You are absolutely right. That, I mean, that really, I think, is the other big piece of that, is that the more cohesive you can make your group as a facilitator, and the more they can connect with each other, that there is a peer pressure there. People will tell each other, where were you? Or I missed you. Or, you know, gosh, I hope you're okay. And people get worried and concerned about each other, and they start connecting. So, and I think that, you know, while people don't want to miss any of the information or the activities, you know, they do rather, in this group in particular, they kind of actually enjoy the process in some ways, that they just miss each other. That's their one time. And then a lot of people will actually say, this is our date night for right now. This is our date night. And that is the one time they do get to connect with other people. So I think that's a huge part of that as well.
Well, as you certainly appropriately mentioned in the paper, this is a first, taking a new intervention specifically focused for couples following brain injury and testing it in a randomized fashion. Congratulations for doing that work. It's very important work, and it's great that we're you know, bringing these types of treatments to this patient population. It's a kind of a relatively common theme, I suppose, with brain injury, that we end up seeing sometimes parallels published in other patient populations and other conditions first before they come to ours. It does require a lot of thought and innovation to bring that forward, and you crafted something specific here to this population. I know that you've already done some work in the realm of starting to try to popularize this and train others. That's my understanding, or that's what you intend to do going forward?
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, I certainly would like to continue to run our clinical groups and collect data on that, so that I do have more information to share and help other clinicians problem solve, because it is the first two studies. So certainly I hope that we can do more and explore more with this. And like I mentioned in the article, it does come with, you know, limitations. So we have learned a lot from how we ran this, and better understanding that there are certain individuals and certain couples that it's not appropriate for them to be in this group. And that sounds horrible saying that, you know, because it's developed to help individuals. So and so there's so much that there's so much to continue to be learned. I do hope to one day be able to, you know, teach other clinicians about this, and so that others can use it. I also recognize that I have a lot to learn and continue to sort of hone and sharpen some of the things that we want to do in this program. And I also just want to quickly say that I don't get this out right now, that I am, you know, I am so utterly grateful for all of the contributors. I certainly do not consider this program alone to be my program alone. Everyone on this paper had a tremendous contribution to conceptualizing this and helping to work through all of these kinks. And so I'm very, very grateful. So I hope that as a group, you know, who's on these two papers with me, that we can continue to also be a part of that process and disseminating and teaching others and learning from that. So
excellent. On the concrete level, if somebody is reading this paper or listening to this interview and says, you know what, we need to start doing this in our brain injury program, what do they need to do? Reach out to you via email? Are there materials online? What's the next step?
Yeah, that's a great question too. I would say, please feel free to reach out to me via email. I don't remember if it's on the paper or not, but I can provide it here if you want me to. And yes, please reach out to me via email. I'm happy to talk about what they are looking for. I mean, if they're just wanting ideas, if they want references, or if they actually want to learn the intervention itself. And we are absolutely happy to do that and teach them. We do have a manual. So just like for the Bix intervention, we had published a manual for this. And in a very similar fashion, we do have a very specific manual that takes you through each session, all the modules and what to do and how to do it. So.
Okay. Well, excellent. Well, I think everyone who treats brain injury has experience with seeing divorce, you know, after brain injury and couples breaking up and are aware of the incredible detrimental effect that certainly has on the individual who is trying to recover after that. And, you know, so interventions to prevent that outcome are desperately needed. I suppose that's the next stage as well for your intervention to continue to track folks to see if that outcome is ultimately avoided years down the line.
Yes, correct. Yes, so that's what we're hoping is to avoid that outcome or at least help people, in a healthy way if that is inevitable. So,
sure. Yeah. Can't always be avoided.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr. Backhouse, I really appreciate your time today and helping us elucidate your paper. And hopefully this interview is a useful entree to everybody. And the paper is quite readable and well-written. And I encourage folks to turn to the pages of the archives and dig in. Again, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Thank you.
And that'll do it for this February 2019 RehabCast. Please join us again next month. And a reminder that ACRM 2019 is in Chicago this year. That's coming right up, and it's time now to make plans for November.
Join us in Chicago this fall for ACRM 2019, the largest interdisciplinary rehabilitation conference in the world. The main core conference and pre-conference instructional courses deliver 6 jam-packed days of evidence-based educational content for the whole rehab team, as well as patients and their caregivers. Please visit acrm.org for more information and follow #ACRM2019.